didn't like the way your tan was in the morning.
Excuse me, is this thing on?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
Hi, and welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard, bringing you the stories behind the greatest rock and roll albums in history. Today, it's part two of In the Studio's tribute to the album that started as a rock opera, then became a film, and now a Broadway production.
Gasp. I mean, I believe that it would be a good work, and I think that it was then, you know, when I heard myself saying that, that I realised that the main problem was going to be that we were going to be labelled forever as being pretentious. And once I was ready to take that on board, I thought, well, that's it, right, for the rest of my life I will be pretentious. You know, I think that I will be a pretender. I will be a pretender to grander ideas. I will always want more from this great music and for this great audience than we're currently getting. That what we're getting now isn't enough. Listening to you. And in the studio for the making of The Who's Tommy Part 2.
If there was one song that could be considered the main attraction or the focal point of Tommy the Rock Opera, it would have to be Pinball Wizard, which is where we begin Part 2 of In the Studio's tribute to Tommy. Released as a single prior to the full album in 1969, Pinball Wizard became a huge hit for The Who and a staple in their live show for years to follow. The song was also the turning point for the story of Tommy. It's during Pinball Wizard that we first begin to see Tommy in a different light. Pinball Wizard also caused quite a controversy for The Who when it was initially released in their native England. More on that in just a bit. Ironically, it was one of the last songs written for Tommy. Here's Pete Townsend.
It was a fairly spontaneous piece, which I think is probably why it's so good. It also came towards the end of the album. We delivered the album for preview to a friend of ours called Nick Cohen, who was a writer for the Manchester Guardian. He was very young. I think he was only about 20 years old. He was the youngest pop writer in England at the time, working for a conventional newspaper. And he hadn't really liked Tommy, and I was very disappointed. I expected him to like it, and he said it's okay, you know. And we went out, and we were, you know, shooting pinball in some arcade somewhere. And I said to him, you know, if Tommy was a pinball player, would you be more receptive to the idea? And he turned around to me and he said, yeah. So I went home and I wrote the song. And then I replayed him the piece with all of the references to Tommy, rather than just being a spiritual leader, being a pinball player. And so the pinball became a metaphor for the life of a rock star, or even the life of a guru. And Nick said, it's great, it works. He said, it's not just great because you've done this for me, you know, and I will give it a good review. He said, what it's actually done is it's add some colour and some real pop to this otherwise really quite boring idea about kind of the spiritual life, you know. He actually found the idea quite kind of depressing, and he felt that when I introduced pinball, and I wrote the song in an hour or 2 hours. I went back and sort of knocked it out and did a two-track demo, acoustic guitar with an electric guitar overdub, took it to the studio and we recorded it, and very, very simple song to do.
Another reason for Pinball's success was the music. It's a majestic piece that combines Townsend's power electric guitar chords with his now signature acoustic guitar strumming. I asked Pete Townsend if his use of acoustic guitar throughout Tommy was sheer genius or pure necessity.
No, I think genius. I think if there's anything that I can claim in my life as genius, it's that way I play on that song. I think it was a discovery of a technique which is actually very, very complex. It's much more complex than it readily appears. It's about the way that you hold the pick. The pick has to float in midair. It mustn't be held. It mustn't be held stiffly. It has to be float between the fingers so that the strokes on the guitar are completely feather-light. And, of course, the danger is that while the pick is floating, you drop it. So the technique is to develop a technique where the pick is floating gently between the fingers, but you never drop it. And once you can actually master that, you can do anything on the acoustic guitar. You can do 64th strokes, whatever you want to do. Almost as though you were just, you know, letting your finger go into kind of overload. You know, it's the only thing that I ever was really, really vain about as a musician was that. I always used to think, well, you know, Steve Stills might be cool, but he can never do that. Nobody can ever do that. Jimi Hendrix might be okay, but what a wanky acoustic player he is, you know. You know, nobody can do that.
Song, but it had controversy. Here's Pete Townsend on the controversy surrounding the song Pinball Wizard.
The BBC banned Pinball Wizard briefly. But Pinball Wizard was released before the album, and out of context it seemed like, you know, a pop band singing about a deaf, dumb and blind kid. It seemed gratuitous. But once the BBC got the album and saw the context of the piece, then they immediately unbanned it. By which time, of course, it was number 4 in the charts. But and there were a few red faces, you know. I mean, a couple of guys that I know on radio, I think, regretted, you know, having spoken so quickly and so loudly. But, you know, it wasn't their fault. It did seem a bit crass, you know.
Although the brief ban by the BBC didn't affect the public's response to Pinball Wizard, I asked Townsend how the press reacted to the album as a whole when it was released shortly thereafter.
Because of the way that we handled it, because we'd had the salutary lesson of Pinball Wizard being attacked for being sick, what we did is we pandered absolutely to the main spice of journalist life. We hired a club and we gave them free booze and we entertained them. And so the reviews were ecstatic, generally. There were a few exceptions. There were people that found it pretentious, that people that found the whole thing distasteful. But it was all spectacular news, whatever it was. It was well received in the manner that you want something to be well received. I mean, some people hated it and some people loved it, but everybody spoke very loudly about it. And the stunning thing about it was, I mean, what I do remember prior to the press show at Ronnie Scott's was Keith Moon and me driving back from Ealing, where we'd actually spent 2 days rehearsing the show. You know, in fact, I say 2 days, we weren't all that keen on rehearsal, I think it was 1 day, running the show down. And we went to a pub in Ealing and propped up the bar for half an hour. And Keith was a difficult guy in those days, you know, it was very difficult to ever know, you know, when he was being sincere or when he was, you know, winding you up or whatever. And he just looked at me and he just said, you know, Pete, he said, I'm so proud of the fact that we can play that thing. And I said to him, yeah, I am too. And he said, and what makes me really proud is that it was so easy. It was so easy. He said, I was, you know, because it's taken 3 months to record, he said, I just thought it was going to be a nightmare. He said, I'm so proud of myself that I can remember it all and that we can do it. And I said, yeah, I said, I feel exactly that way. And then he said, you know, this is going to be extraordinary to play live. It's going to change our life. And I said, yeah, I think you're right. Anyway, we went off, and I don't think we ever got a full feeling of the measure of how true that was until we started to tour the States with it, where you were given a 2-hour slot if you wanted it, whereas in the UK they were still trying to get you off the stage. You know, they were literally, it would be pulling the curtain down if you played for more than 35 minutes, you know, it's kind of...
That's Go to the Mirror Boy, featuring a conversation between Tommy, his father, and the doctor. Ironically, it was a conversation that Pete Townsend had back in 1968 with Rolling Stone magazine, where, for the first time, Townsend fully explained this vision he had for a rock opera called Tommy.
When I actually really put the whole thing together in my own mind was in a conversation, a long, long, long conversation, after a Fillmore show in San Francisco with Jan Wenner. And we were just buddies at the time, you know, and Rolling Stone was a kind of San Francisco broadsheet. We went to hang out over there and do this interview for his magazine. And I just started to tell the story. And about halfway through, I started to really freak, and I said to him, am I making sense? And he said, you're making a lot of sense. So I carried on. And what he actually did was he printed the whole article, the whole conversation. It was a 2 or 3 hour conversation. He printed it absolutely verbatim. And so I had a record of this moment, you know, which was me and him and some other people that I respected sitting around talking about this album that we were about to make. We hadn't even really started recording it. And that became my blueprint. And so what I actually had was a book.
Illustration of Tommy's mother with Tommy, Can You Hear Me? And Smash the Mirror. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio with Pete Townsend for part two of our tribute to The Who's Tommy. The story continues right after this. Last week, The Who were pretty much known for being a singles band up until Tommy. So it must have been quite an interesting meeting when Townsend first presented this ambitious idea to Keith Moon, John Entwistle, and Roger Daltrey of The Who.
I can't remember the early discussions. All I can remember is a general feeling of being amazed at how supportive everybody in the band was. Because, you know, I think I'd made a few dumb mistakes just prior to Tommy, and was getting a bit silly. And I think that it might have appeared that this was another one of those silly things, like, you know, songs about dog racing or whatever. But I think they really recognised that it was a good idea. And it wasn't a completely formed idea, and they were very, very helpful in forming it. John wrote two great songs, as you know, Cousin Kevin and Uncle Ernie. Keith helped me with the holiday camp idea. Roger never wrote anything, actually, for the piece, but certainly was very, very hard-working and evident and supportive of the idea.
Smashing of the Mirror and the song Sensation, Tommy has been miraculously cured in the story. It's no surprise that the spiritual side of Pete Townsend comes to the surface in the story of Tommy. To understand where Townsend was coming from, you have to examine the things that were inspiring him during the writing period of Tommy. Townsend was a big follower of Mayor Baba, the same Baba in Baba O'Reilly on Who's Next, and Pete was a big believer in mysticism.
Where a lot of the joy of the discovery of mysticism for me came from was Sufi writing, particularly the musician Inayat Khan, who was a world-class international musician who actually became a spiritual master and wrote lots of books about music and art as well as, you know, the spiritual life. And I found his writing very evocative. It was a bit like kind of reading about quantum mechanics or you know, the Big Bang theory or the free lunch theory or something. Actually, a lot of the early writing were almost kind of like, you know, reading about science and physics. And also kind of infused with this feeling that maybe music was mystical, magical, which is what, you know, when you're a musician, you know, people keep telling you how talented you are, and what, you know, what you want to say to them is, hold on, you know, this isn't talent, this is magic.
Extra, extra, read all about.
Now come to the story of Sally Simpson, a girl overwhelmed by her love, or call it infatuation, with Tommy, who's now reached the popularity status equal of that to a big-name rock and roll star. And poor old Sally Simpson will do just about anything to meet her idol.
The problem with celebrity is that it's not manufactured by the artist at all. Some guy was in a bar, one of the guys from the crew, Tommy Crew. He said that he had a pal who was an extra and had driven Madonna around on a documentary shoot. And they went round the block to reshoot her arriving at some club or something. And so it was just him and her in the car. And they came to some traffic lights and some girls on a corner noticed her. And she kind of ducked down, and he said, you know, you no need to duck down, they're not going to hurt you, just wave at them. And she said to him, do you really think I should? In a way, that kind of says it all. It just says it all. You know, it's like, you know, you are, as an artist, as a star, you belong to, you are charged by your audience. They are the ones that you ultimately, you know, you want to know whether they want you, those kids, to act like an arsehole, to ignore them, or to wave at them. And you've got to try and divine that. Because if you wave at them, you might not be, You might actually be reducing yourself in their eyes. You know, depends how they see you. You know, so sometimes when people say, you know, I met Jack Nicholson on a plane the other day, and he's a really nice guy, and you think, well, okay, Jack, that's one fan you've lost. Now you're his best buddy. You know, he'll never go and see you in a movie again. You know, it's difficult. It's difficult, and I think that what Sally Simpson actually addresses is the difficulty that I was having with that at the time, and I think that I have less difficulty with it today.
Sally Simpson from Tommy. Coming up next, the conclusion to Tommy the Rock Opera, plus more insight from the writer and creator, Pete Townsend. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for The Who's Tommy, Part 2.
Townsend, in the studio for the making of The Who's Tommy, Part 2.
And I'm Redbeard. In speaking with Pete Townsend about this wonderful piece of music, this rock opera called Tommy, you get the sense that the most difficult challenge wasn't the songwriting, or the recording, or the performance, but rather Pete Townsend convincing himself that he would survive artistically whether Tommy succeeded or failed. Townsend did a lot of soul-searching before he finally realized that he just had to make this album, Tommy.
It really was a last gasp. I mean, I believe that it would be a good work, and I think that it was then, you know, when I heard myself saying that, that I realized that the main problem was going to be that we were going to be labeled forever as being pretentious. And once I was ready to take that on board, I thought, well, that's it, right, for the rest of my life I will be pretentious. You know, I think that I will be a pretender. I will be a pretender to grander ideas. I will always want more from this great music and for this great audience than we're currently getting. That what we're getting now isn't enough. I didn't think Pink Floyd were good enough. I thought that they were interesting, but I didn't think that they were enough. I didn't think the Soft Machine were enough. I didn't think Arthur Brown was enough. I didn't actually think Jimi Hendrix was enough. It was masterful, it was brilliant, and he was a great, great genius, but it wasn't going to do any... It wasn't... You know, he was still just an island. It wasn't going to change everything else. You know, and what Jimmy has done, really, is I suppose he's just upped the ante on the style of guitar... quality of guitar playing that's been required in rock ever since. But it hasn't changed the form. It didn't change the form. And I think, interestingly enough, you know, Tommy didn't change the form. There hasn't been, you know, a rash of rock operas since. So at that particular time, I think Jimmy was one of the reasons that, you know, I was so desperate. There was no way in hell I was ever going to be... I knew I could never play like Eric... But at least I had my stunts, you know. At least I had my guitar style and my arm swinging and my guitar smashing and, you know, my Union Jack jacket or whatever I was into, suddenly that all looked like so much dust, you know, like so much magic dust, so much kind of like so many kind of sequins falling off a busker's jacket, you know, and I just felt like, my God, I've got to be honest now. What am I? I'm a writer. I'm an ideas man. I'm a simple soul. Address that. Do it. If people think it's fine, you know, at least it's you. And so Tommy was a very, very kind of honest, direct piece of work. Came out of an adversity of, you know, which was partly financial but also partly emotional. You know, I could see psychedelics had come along and changed the audience perception. Although it was only kind of brief, you know, when we came to America, it seemed almost like a revolution. But when we were exposed to it in America, we were exposed to it at the Monterey Pop Festival, you know, which was, you know, one of the great early psychedelic events where maybe half or a third of the people in the audience had taken some kind of hallucinogenic drug, even if it was just, you know, lots of marijuana.
Rock radio staple from the rock opera Tommy. That's called I'm Free. Over the years, Townsend has worn many different hats when it comes to Tommy, with the Broadway production in full gear and with 11 Tony nominations. I asked Pete Townsend what his role is now.
I'm the co-book writer. That's what I did. I wrote the book with Des McAnuff. And the book in music theatre is like the film script in a film. It's a, you know, 100-page document with directions, dialogue, scene descriptions, a certain rhythmic pace inferred, you know, the show divided into acts, the lyrics. And that becomes the blueprint for the production, and makes, obviously, and infers and demands certain technical requirements of the show. I've done much, much more on the show than I ever thought I would. But I'm also there, you know, the cast continually tell me that, you know, that I'm also there as something, as a kind of a presence.
At Woodstock.
Welcome.
There have been many memorable performances of Tommy, some in which The Who played Tommy from the beginning to end, and others where they highlighted some of the best songs from the opera. The Who set at Woodstock featured quite a few songs from Tommy, and also featured The Who in their prime as a live band. Pete Townshend has this recollection from that middle-of-the-night performance in upstate New York.
When we started listening to You, I Get the Music, it was dark. And I just kept playing it until the sun came up. I think we played it for 25 minutes, listening to You, I Get the Music. And the audience were starting to kind of get a bit fed up with it, I think. And then suddenly, the sun broke over the hill. I was kind of praying for it. And they just went berserk. The sun just went boing, tsh, you know. And then we played it for another 20 minutes. I remember John Entwistle being very pissed off that I'd kept it going for so long.
I get opinions. From you, I get the story. Thank you, Pete Townshend, for giving us the story in the studio for The Who's Tommy, Part 2. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back for a final word in just a moment.